God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right, so everybody, welcome back to the... Are we still calling it the Get Your Film Fix podcast? Yeah, we'll call it that still. I'm Lee Carlo. I'm with Jeremy Fisk, Chapin Hemingway, and Tyson Balcom. All four of us are here for the second go-round at the podcast. We've taken some serious time off to regroup, get our thoughts together, to explore.
Yourself? Explore yourself?
Thank you. I was waiting for someone to, to grab that. And Asia. But today we're going to kick it all back off with the third annual Fixie Awards, third annual Fixie Award nomination show, where we go through our best films of 2012. Full disclosure, we didn't see all of the so-called great films. I know each one of us missed a few big ones, but we'll do our best to have some entertaining discussions on the ones we did see, the films, performances, and... screenplays and directors of the year. Let's hear your top however many best supporting actresses you got.
Okay, I have four. Okay.
Whoa, that's
pretty good.
Yeah, more than I had. I had to think about the math there.
And I'll do five just to throw it in because I was just thinking about it. My fifth one would be Jessica Chastain in Lawless.
Lawless, okay.
Oh, that's a good one.
My number four is Judi Dench in Skyfall.
Hot.
My number, this is my list of the hottest women. My number three is Kelly Riley in Flight. My number two is Kerry Washington in Django Unchained. And my number one is Amy Adams from Z Master.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
An interesting list. Jeremy, why don't you run down yours?
I mean, I have Amy Adams number three in The Master, and I really didn't even want to put her in this. I didn't think she was anything special in that movie. My number two is the sexy Judi Dench in Skyfall. And my number one is Sally Field in Lincoln.
Okay. Thanks to Chapin, I just was able to throw on two throwaways. I got Jessica Chastain in Lawless as my number five. Kerry Washington, who I thought was good, is my number four, although I just didn't think she was in the movie quite enough to really warrant putting on her on the list. Number three, Amy Adams. I actually feel the exact same way as you do, Jeremy. She's on there by default. My number two is Jackie Weaver in Silver Linings Playbook, and my number one is Sally Field.
God, I can't wait to have these huge arguments. Just huge.
Can we please
arguments.
Talk about Jackie Weaver in Silver Linings Playbook and tell me what she did to deserve any sort of acclaim?
Are we sure that Jackie Weaver was even in Silver Linings Playbook?
I mean, she was like, there was you can't watch that movie and watch her and be like, there's an Oscar-worthy performance. She did
honestly
nothing interesting.
I couldn't, when I was just driving home,
Tyson,
Mallory said.
Let's do your list first.
So I had Judi Dench in Skyfall number four, Kerry Washington in Django number three, Sally Field in Lincoln number two. This was tough for me, and Amy Adams in The Master number one. I'm surprised to hear you guys say that about her because I don't know how in depth we're going to talk about each of these categories, but Amy Adams in particular on this list was the one I thought for me was really clear cut. Every time she was on the screen, like I was, there was something about it where I like found myself feeling a little bit uncomfortable. The way that she like sort of looked down on Joaquin Phoenix's character, and the way that she, you know, the way that she sort of like reined Philip Seymour Hoffman in regularly. I don't know. I just thought she was great, and I think it was a tough role to play. And I'm surprised to hear you guys say that you didn't think she was that great.
I have a really hard time buying in wholeheartedly to Amy Adams, even when she's good. Like I thought she was good in The Fighter too, but I still. Something about her and the performances she gives and that I just can't totally buy into. And I'm never overwhelmingly impressed by her. I'm just satisfied with her. In response to you guys' Jackie Weaver thoughts, I mean, she wasn't – I wouldn't necessarily classify her as the weakest link of that movie. She wasn't a weak link. She was not in it very much. I mean, I thought – I mean, again, we're dealing with a Best Supporting Actress list that I had to struggle to get three on. But I thought she was good. I mean, and maybe it's a little bit of reputation that got that slid her on there on just based on the fact that she was great in Animal Kingdom as well. But she didn't really have a lot to do, and that wasn't necessarily her fault. But she was fine with what she was. She was good with what she was given.
You also have to kind of buy into that movie in order to sort of buy her performance. And if you didn't, yeah. I don't think you'd buy into any of those guys.
I have a feeling my work is cut out for me in this.
I really think it's going to be. I mean, thank God that we get to do these fixies, because this like Academy Awards beauty contest horseshit is ridiculous.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
Definitely beauty contest. Jackie Weaver.
Judy Dench, you're right.
So hot.
I mean, Sally Field, Meet and Jeremy's number one. I mean, I thought she was unbelievable. Did you not see Lincoln?
I saw Lincoln, but I slept through the majority of that movie. I have people on the list from Lincoln, but I mean, I don't know. Like, to be honest, the whole thing is dubious because I don't even feel like I saw that movie.
She was really good. And
yeah, she was.
the scene that I think about in particular is the scene where you first see her and Tommy Lee Jones on the screen at the same time, and she's sort of accosting him in front of all of these people.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I thought she.
Yeah, I liked her. I should put her on my list. She'll be my number five. I'm sorry,
Tyson. You want to kick us off with supporting actor?
My number five is Alan Arkin from Argo. My number four was Javier Bardem in Skyfall. My number three was Tommy Lee. This was really tough. These last three. Well, not the first one. My number three was Tommy Lee Jones in Lincoln. My number two was Christoph Waltz in Django Unchained.
Can I guess number one?
Yeah, you can guess. You could go fuck yourself. And my number one,
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Your man crush?
In Django Unchained. And the fact that he wasn't nominated is enough for me to not even watch. If I didn't want to win money off of Chapin this year after last year, I wouldn't even watch the Oscars for this horse shit.
All right. My number five is Robert De Niro, Silver Linings Playbook. Number four is Christoph Waltz in Django Unchained. My number three is Samuel Jackson in Django Unchained. My number two, Pierce Gagnon in Looper. And number one, Tommy Lee Jones in Lincoln.
Who is Pierce Gagnon?
He's a little kid in Looper.
Yeah, he was really good. That's a good pick.
Oh, that kid. Hey, that is good.
Yeah, that is actually my number five, Lee, with Pierce Gagnon. Because of all of these performances, none made or broke a movie more than
right,
his.
Right, than his, yeah.
He could have made that movie not work at all if they did not find a little kid that worked in that role. So he definitely needs to be mentioned. So that's
he'd had a lot of acting experience on One Tree Hill, so it's not like he was a rookie.
I mean, it's how old was he in that movie?
No, 10.
Yeah. So my number four, and I didn't even think of Sam Jackson. That's a good one, but I went with Christopher Walken in Seven Psychopaths.
I didn't see that.
My number three is Leo DiCaprio.
Thank you, Lee. I mean, Jeremy, sorry.
You're welcome. No, my number two is Philip Seymour Hoffman from The Master. And my number one is Christoph Waltz.
Chapin?
Oh, my number five is Chris Tucker in Silver Linings Playbook. Number four
The Dark Knight.
Number three is Leonardo DiCaprio in Django.
Where'd you go?
Unchained. My number two is Christoph Waltz in Django Unchained, and my number one is Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Master.
So you do a really good Bane impression, and I love the Chris Tucker pick because I thought he was hilarious in Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah, for the 5 minutes that he was in it, if it even made sense. But sure, yeah, definitely.
Gosh, Tyson.
I think we need to have a conversation about Silver Linings Playbook at some point.
We'll get to it. I think save that for the bigger categories, I think. That's interesting that Bane was on your list. I mean, I felt like Dark Knight Rises just performances, screenplays, directions, picture had no place on a best of list of 2012. All right, so screenplay, I got number five, I got Looper. Number four, I've got Lincoln. Number three, Zero Dark Thirty. Number two, Django Unchained. And number one, Tyson, is Silver Linings Playbook.
Ooh, Jesus Christ.
This is kind of cool to see because now we don't know what everybody thought about the movies because we haven't done the podcast till now.
That's true. We should actually only do this once a year.
Yeah.
What, the podcast? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, do we? Is this the appropriate time to argue about these points?
No, let's just wait till we all
let's
get,
just get
a,
our
get
lists and just we can argue. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Go ahead, Jeremy, for screenplay.
Okay, I will go with the. And again, this will be an interesting conversation to have. But I did go number five as Silver Linings Playbook, number four as Moonrise Kingdom, number three Lincoln, number two Zero Dark Thirty, and number one Django.
Okay, screenplay. I have number five Flight. Number four, Silver Linings Playbook, the controversial Silver Linings Playbook.
Doesn't sound like that controversial.
Number three,
it's on everybody's list.
The controversial Zero Dark Thirty. Number two, Django Unchained. And number one, The Master by Paul Thomas
Anderson. We're going to have this conversation now. All right, Tyson, what's your list?
My number five was The Master. My number four was Zero Dark Thirty. My number three was Looper. My number two was Moonrise Kingdom, and my number one was Django Unchained.
What is Moonrise Kingdom doing on any of your lists?
Seriously.
That movie sucked.
Yeah, I liked it.
I'll tongue my balls, okay? Except Jeremy. Yeah. Well, Jeremy, I'll tongue
your balls. But Tyson, you want to lick Wes Anderson's balls. So.
Yeah.
And so The Master, I mean, it is a good script, and it reminds me actually of Tree of Life, in the sense that, like, I think Paul Thomas Anderson thinks it's a good script. But I just feel like it didn't work.
Well, what I'll say is I think I will probably share some of your disappointment with that movie. But mostly, I think the problems with that movie have to do with the direction, and I think what I liked about the movie came from the screenplay. I mean, it's hard to analyze these movies that are done by auteurs. You know, like when you're looking at, you know, Django or Silver Linings Playbook or The Master, you have to sort of say, well, what was the response? You know, this is there's one guy writing and directing this movie, and how do I break up? It's sort of
how do you
one
separate
vision,
the two?
Right? And I think that what I liked about The Master, I think the problems I have with The Master were more to do with the direction than from the screenplay.
I agree with that, because I think, like, tonally the movie bothered me more than anything. So in that sense, I agree, but. I mean, I couldn't. My biggest problem with the movie was I didn't know what he was trying to say with it, and like I think that all comes down to the screenplay. Like, I didn't know what his end goal was, what he was trying to establish with his characters, and what his relationships were between Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix in particular. But those are the things that I struggled to grasp onto, and I think that comes from the screenplay. So that being something missing, that's what hurt it for me.
I'm just, as far as The Master is concerned, I think there's a point, and it's The Master sort of crosses it, and we start to see the crossing of the line on Tree of Life, where sort of ambiguity and artistry disguise a lack of a good movie, for a better word. Like, we know these we're going in with knowing these directors are amazing, and the cinematography is amazing, and these performances are amazing, and we know that these directors have made great works, and we know that they must be saying something important, or else, like, you know, why else would they have made the movie? And we sort of disguise those aspects of it, and maybe even sort of lie to ourselves and say, yeah, I get it, I understand, and maybe it's not there. Maybe there's nothing. The redeeming quality isn't as amazing as we hope or think it may be.
What do we got next? Best actresses of the year?
Yeah.
Jeremy, why don't you kick us off there?
Oh, okay. I only have four of them, but my number four is this woman is very attractive. Helen Mirren.
Yes.
Hitchcock.
Oh, I didn't see that. I want to talk about that. All right.
My number three is Jennifer Lawrence from Silver Linings Playbook, the ever controversial Silver Linings Playbook.
We'll get to it.
I'm not going to be able to pronounce her name, but the little girl from Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Let's just all try to say her name.
Kavanzan Wallace.
Wallace. You got it.
I have missed Jeremy's pronouncing things.
Well, that's not fair. I mean, It's not like he's saying, like,
it's a pretty tough one, no doubt.
It's, yeah.
And number one is Jessica Chastain from Zero Dark Thirty.
All right. I got, I think I got a kind of an interesting list. I've got my number five. I have Keira Knightley in Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. I have at number four the, I mean, all she has to do is be in a movie, Michelle Williams in Take This Waltz. Number three, I've got Kvensane Wallace, Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Rashida number two, Wallace.
Number two, Jennifer Lawrence, Silver Linings Playbook, and number one, Jessica Chastain, Zero Dark Thirty.
Okay, I have two people on my list. I have Jessica Chastain, who I actually thought was not very good in Zero Dark Thirty, but she was all right, and Jennifer Lawrence is my number one.
My list only has three people. I feel a little bit guilty. And I only put these people because they were movies that I'd seen, but honestly, I don't think I'm surprised to some extent that Jessica Chastain is even nominated, let alone is going to win. But she's on my list at number three. At number two, I had Kara Hayward from Moonrise Kingdom. And number one, I had, and this is the only part of the movie that I thought was okay, Jennifer Lawrence from Silver Linings Playbook. And it's not just because she's got a fantastic rack.
Okay, yeah. So isn't she like 14 or something?
No, she's like 23 or 22. Like, she's old enough, dude.
Old enough.
Yeah.
So why didn't you guys like Jessica Chastain?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Honestly, like, and on tape, he and I have already had a conversation about this. I felt like at least for the I can remember this scene where I really felt like it changed, but I felt like for the first half of the movie, I didn't believe her as a character. Like, I felt like reading words off of the
movie. I would agree with that, but I would agree with that wholeheartedly, that as that movie got going, but I felt like that movie itself had a hard time finding its stride at the beginning.
Yeah. It wasn't, and that may be the case. I thought it was, the scene when she's, you guys will have to help me out. I don't remember who she's yelling at. I think that it's Mark Strong, but no,
no, it's, I think that it's Mark Palmer guy. It's the other guy.
Oh yeah.
The guy who's also in Argo playing the same role.
Yeah. That scene is the scene where I thought she really turned it around. Isn't it Kyle Chandler? Isn't that who it was?
Yeah, that's who it is.
Was it Jason Clark?
No, Kyle Chandler, the guy from Friday Night Lights.
From Friday Night Lights. But I just felt like up until that point, I just didn't believe her as character. I thought it literally seemed – and maybe I went in with some like preconceived notions. I do think she's a good actress. I really liked her in Lawless. I really liked her in The Help. I really liked her in that movie The Debt. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but – so I had my hopes up, and I think I was just kind of disappointed. And maybe that's a component, like Lee was saying, that it hits doubly hard for you when you like somebody and they don't do it for you. But I just, up until that point in the movie, I didn't buy her. And I don't think that that should warrant you winning. I mean, I know these awards don't mean shit anymore, but a fixie does, goddammit. A fixie means something, and I'm not going to give her mine. For half a performance. I'm really not. I just think that it's
crude.
Amen.
Well, the counter argument, and this is how I found her. I got what she was going for right from the beginning. Like, I understood that this is a character that's driven by one thing and one thing only, and she has poor social skills, and she's not very likable, and there's really. She's just one of those classic sort of obsessed characters that you get, and I think she pulls that off, and I can see where somebody can watch it and just kind of see her as quiet, reserved, and not doing much and literally just being on screen. But I don't know, I saw the sort of the fire within her within that character to, you know, track down Osama bin Laden, and I totally bought in to it right from the beginning, and I thought she totally worked for it. So yeah, I think that's where the praise is coming from.
I think she played up the subtlety of her character very well. I mean, there were scenes where she exploded on people, and like little bits of the movie that I didn't like, which weren't necessarily her fault, like writing the days on the window of her boss's office and stuff. Like, it was too on the nose. Like,
well, that was also something that they kind of, like, I could see them being like, that's super cinematic and let's do that.
Right,
or exactly. I'm the motherfucker who, you know, that scene.
But what I think worked best was with her was like the subtleties of her performance, like the way she interacted with like the other woman that worked there, like at first how they didn't get along, and like, well, you know, that again was a little on the nose as well, like to establish that relationship. But I think she just worked that very well. Like, she said a lot without saying anything. She did a lot with like her eyes, and I just think that's what worked. And like, I mean, even you look at her in the scene that's always in the trailer when Chris Pratt is like, and what's his name from Animal Kingdom is like, I'm inspired by her confidence. The way she's just standing there, and it's very intimidating, and like it shows like the power that she's gained, and it's all just by the way she's standing there. And I think those are the kind of things that kind of worked really well in her performance.
Maybe this is the right time to bring this up, but what that movie was really strange in that, and I got what they were going for with these characters. Sort of not having a personality. They were kind of, you know, lifeless characters because they were so dedicated to their jobs, and it took them away from any personality they had. But there was that woman who always like looks like Meryl Streep. I forget her name. The one who died in the explosion. She yeah. was really good and seemed to have some
spoiler
personality.
Spoiler alert.
But the weird thing about it was kind of she gave, or the script gave, the most personality in this movie to the SEAL team at the end, which I thought was kind of a strange choice. Like, suddenly there are these, like, likable guys that are sort of... I mean, they are kind of just pawns in this story that we've been watching for 2.5 hours, and they're not particularly important to the plot of the movie. I mean, they are obviously the main guys, but they weren't part of the chase at all. And suddenly they're, like you're suddenly really rooting for them because they're... I mean, I don't know. They were likable and...
Because they're interesting, yeah.
Yeah, they're interesting. But, yeah, I mean, I kind of liked, you know, the end of the movie where she's kind of vacant and sitting on that C-130. It makes sense, her performance. Like, what is she going to do now? She has nothing... I mean, there's nothing left to do. And it's this kind of this feeling your purpose being gone, because she's like just had nothing else on the brain but finding this person, then it's gone, and it's kind of, you know, anticlimactic.
Yeah, I mean, I think the movie was aware of those problems, and it worked for me because I think the movie knew that keeping the audience's interest is going to be because of the stakes of the movie and the situation that we are sort of. We come into the theater somewhat familiar with, but we get to see, like, we get to peel back the news story and see behind it and see how it happened. And I think if I were to watch that movie again, Chape, and I think I would probably agree a lot with what you're saying, on a second viewing, it's not going to hold up as much because not that the characters are paper thin, but they're not characters that sort of have a likability, like you were saying, and something that we can root for their arc throughout the movie. I mean, it works on its the first time you see it because, like I said, just because of the story and the stakes, and we're so familiar with that time in our history and it being so recent that, you know, that in and of itself is going to keep, at least it kept me engaged in the film. But I think there's a lot of truth to what you say, but it's weird that we kind of, you saw it on the first viewing, and I still found that movie engaging.
All right, best actor. Okay.
Best actor.
I'll go first. I haven't gone. We'll just get it out of the way because there's going to be such shit given in about 2 seconds. My number five, but I did try and break from the Norman.
Edward Norton for
that movie where he plays the twins that are weedheads.
Okay, so my number five was Shia LaBeouf in Lawless.
I thought about that, actually. He was on my list until I saw five other movies.
My number four was Joseph Gordon-Levitt in Looper. My number three was Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Master, which I know is debatable as to whether or not he was the act. You know, I just thought he was in it enough to justify it. My number two was Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln, and my number one was Joaquin Phoenix in The Master.
I'm not. I mean, it's okay.
I'm not going to argue with the order necessarily. My number five is Joaquin Phoenix in The Master. My number four is Jamie Foxx in Django. My number three is Ben Affleck in his best performance to date in Argo.
Whoa, that one we have to have a conversation about.
Number two is Bradley Cooper, Silver Linings Playbook. And number one, Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln.
Nice.
Wow. All right. Chapin, why don't you go next?
Okay. My number five is the performance that put me to sleep in Lincoln of Daniel Day-Lewis. Number four, Mr. Denzel Washington, who isn't my favorite actor, but one of my favorites in Flight.
Who's your favorite actor?
My number Mrs. Sidney Poitier. My number two.
You don't have an original thought in us.
Fuck. My number three is Jamie Foxx in Django Unchained. And number two is Bradley Cooper in Silver Linings Playbook. And my number one is Joaquin Phoenix with his pants.
Ten bodies, bitch, Pete.
With his pants around his chest for in The Master.
All right, so my number five is Dane DeHaan in Chronicle. My number four is, as much as I hate to give him credit, Bradley Cooper in Silver Linings Playbook.
I want to talk about that, too.
Yeah, I never thought I'd say that. My number three is Jack Black in Bernie. My number two is Joaquin Phoenix and... Number one, it has to be Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln.
So just a quick thought on Bradley Cooper. I mean, I'm totally there with you. Like, I never thought I'd see the day where I'd be putting him on these lists.
He's likable.
But the thing is that, like, I think we actually had this conversation before, Jeremy, that he is not a good comedic actor. Like, you look at movies like The Hangover, which is just a bad movie, and I even think Wedding Crashers, he's just not funny.
No.
But
he always,
you know,
plays this, like, douchey, sort of unlikable.
Yeah. And he's not funny. And I just think he overacts. But you look at him in a movie in like Silver Linings Playbook, and I think he's fantastic. And I'm like excited to see him now in Derek Cianfrance's new movie with Ryan Gosling, because I think he's doing movies that work with his strengths now. And as much like. Once upon a time, I would have been like, Bradley Cooper will never make a top five list for me. He'll never win a fixie because he sucks. Like, you know, and, you know, so he's going nowhere.
I think you said that when we were six.
Yeah, probably.
It was weird. I'm like, what's a fixie?
And I was like, you will find out. And then, but I think he was amazing in this movie. And I think that's a credit to him, of course. But, like, I also think that it's about time he realized that he should be doing these types of roles.
Okay, but I really need to say that Ben Affleck was the worst part of Argo. I mean, he just was awful in it. He was unwatchable in it. He took me out of the movie in it. And,
in what?
Argo.
Oh, Affleck?
Yes.
Why? I don't understand. I thought that was easily his best performance. Now that's saying...
Because he had a beard?
No, that didn't have anything to do with it. I mean...
He was just, like, so, like, he was washed out. There was nothing, like, there was nothing going. I know his character had a lot of stress, but the way he showed stress was just to, like, look longingly past.
Yeah, I agree.
No, I think he did a really good job at kind of, you know, expressing fear without, like,
being openly afraid. I would not use it. Express. He didn't express anything. He was a blank slate, and it didn't work for that performance.
See, I mean, I'm far from Ben Affleck's biggest fan as an actor. Like, I did not think he was good in The Town at all. I mean, and prior to that, you know, none of his movies are really even worth mentioning as far as, you know, acting goes. But
I thought he was better in The Town than he was in Argo.
No, I mean, I thought he really I thought he did a really good job at kind of, like I said, like, I don't want to use the word expressing again, but portraying the fact that he was also afraid, and that he was afraid of the situation and afraid of everything that was going on, but at the same time kind of keeping his composure because he knew that he had to. I thought that came across really well. And, you know, granted, that was a lot of what that movie was, so that it was a lot of that, but I thought it worked, and I thought he did a good job. And that leaving the movie, actually, and I saw it last night, so I haven't had a ton of time to think about it, but that was the first thing that really stuck with me was his performance.
I don't know. I mean, we must have just watched two different movies because I couldn't disagree more. Tyson, what do you think?
I agree with you, Jeremy. I when you said that about the look longingly, I think certain actors, they just have a ceiling that it might, I don't know if it'll just take them a while to get past or what, but I feel like it's so, his process is so like formulaic. Just take it from me as somebody who's tried to act and done poorly. I feel like that there's just that like prototypical Ben Affleck look that he has. I felt like he had it a lot in The Town, which is interesting.
I didn't think he was good in The Town. I thought he was.
Neither
bad.
Did I. No. I agree. I didn't think he was either. I just feel like that was the component of that story that sort of took me out of it. I wish Chapin had seen it so he could probably agree with us. But
I mean, I agree with you guys on The Town. Like, I really didn't like him in The Town, but I liked him in Argo for all the reasons that I didn't like him in The Town. Like, he like overdoes the drama in The Town. Like, everything is so on the nose, I feel like. And this movie, he was much more subdued, and he really kind of just like let the movie come to him.
He was so trying subdued, to push every it was point. Like I thought he got shot with a tranquilizer before.
No joke. And I mean, look, I love Ben Affleck as a guy. I'm so pumped that he won that honorary Oscar at the Golden Globes. But he should just do himself a favor and start casting Matt Damon in his movies, or his brother, or anyone else.
That's interesting.
I mean,
because
it's true. I mean, I actually, to be honest, now that you mention it, like Matt Damon or Casey Affleck would have rocked Argo with that role.
Yeah,
in Argo.
I agree. Like,
but that doesn't take anything away from Ben Affleck. Just because somebody else could have done it better doesn't mean he did it poorly.
Okay, let's go to Best Director.
All right.
Okay. Chape, you want to go first?
Sure. This is going to be a controversial list, too.
Take that, baby.
Okay, my number 5 is Joe Carnahan for The Gray. My number 4 is Christopher Nolan for The Dark Knight Rises. My number 3...
What?
My number 3 is... Oh, shit, I realized I left one off the list. My number 3 is Catherine Bigelow for Zero Dark Thirty. My number 2 is... Oh, God, hold on. Sorry, I messed my list up because it skipped
the
page.
Yeah, I know. With
excuse me. My number 3 is... what's his name? Who's the guy who directed Silver Linings Playbook?
David O. Russell.
David O. Russell is my number 3. My number 2 is Catherine Bigelow for Zero Dark Thirty, and my number 1 is Quentin Tarantino for Django Unchained.
I honestly think that the Christopher Nolan pick is more controversial than the Joe Carnahan pick.
I do too. I don't know why Joe Carnahan would be on that list, but
let me explain that one. Okay, I thought I had some mixed feelings about The Gray. I don't know if any of you guys have seen. I know Tyson. I know you've seen it, but
I saw it.
I thought that movie had this moments of intensity that were so incredible. Some of the most intense moments I've seen in the last couple of years. But it was just plagued by an awful, awful script. And I was just trying to separate directing. Because, like, how do you separate directing from Best Picture? You know, how do you do that? And I think, though he wrote the script, Joe Carnahan, as a director, did a fantastic job with a very bad script. And I thought that movie...
So how do you defend... I mean, I guess you could make the same argument with Christopher Nolan, but... I mean,
exactly.
But that movie wasn't well directed, though. Like, it had such... I mean,
but,
it's just
but,
like... Had
but
such,
those
like,
problems, I think, were related to the script, yes.
All right, let me give my list. Number 5, Ben Affleck for Argo. Number 4, Quentin Tarantino for Django Unchained. Number 3, Rian Johnson for Looper. Number 2, Steven Spielberg for Lincoln. And number 1, David O. Russell, Silver Linings Playbook.
Ugh.
Ugh.
All right, my number... guys, there's two obvious answers. Number 1 and 2 should be across the board the same this year. I don't get it. All right, my number 5 is Rian Johnston for Looper.
Who's Rian Johnston?
I think he's a distant cousin of Rian Johnson.
Yeah, maybe. But that have different last names.
I'm trying to make a Looper joke where it's like something to do with time travel. Number 4 is Catherine Bigelow for Zero Dark Thirty. Number 3, Ben Affleck for Argo. Number 2, Quentin Tarantino for for Django, and number one, Steven Spielberg for Lincoln. I mean, those top two are just easily the best displays of directing.
I agree with you with Lincoln, just because, I mean, Spielberg managed to make a movie which was just talking about politics, and yet people, it was so interesting that like you couldn't possibly fall asleep during it.
Unless you're Chapin. Okay, I agree. My number five.
I was pretty drunk when I went into that movie, to be honest.
Sure, he was.
God, kind of like I Am Legend.
Yep.
My number five. I mean,
the ironic thing is the lesson you get out of that movie is don't fall asleep in a theater.
Yeah, no doubt.
No, no kidding.
Okay, my number five was Ben Affleck. In Argo, my number four was Rian Johnson in Looper, or for Looper. My number three was Catherine Bigelow for Zero Dark Thirty. My number two was Steven Spielberg for Lincoln, for many of the reasons that Jeremy just said. And my number one was QT, Django Unchained.
So, Rian Johnson, I mean, he was all on our list, but like, I think he gets credit just for making a time travel movie work.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
That automatically gets you nominated.
Yeah, I mean, he had some really, like, I mean, if we were to break down, like, our favorite scenes of the year, I definitely put on that scene from Looper, the scene about where Paul Dano is running away, but they have older version.
Awesome. Yeah.
That is such a cool and innovative scene. And that is, like, that's sort of a display of what, you know, I mean, it's very cinematic, you know? I really want to talk about why I think, like, and you could even throw maybe PTA on this list, if you were a fan of The Master, but why like Tarantino and Spielberg need to be considered at the tops of the list, because like Chapin, like you said, and I don't think it was a totally disappointing year in movies in general, but when you get somebody like Spielberg working at the top of their game and you get somebody like Tarantino working at the top of their game, there's literally nobody better. So you watch a movie like Django and you remember like what is so fun about going to the movies and what works when you're sitting in that theater surrounded by other people and engaged together watching a film. I mean, nothing portrays that more than a Tarantino movie, and Django did that. And
the bar for me with Django is set so high, though. Like,
but you can't forget that he's using the medium in a way that is almost better than anyone else.
But he didn't do anything overly innovative with Django the way he has in the past, and like that's why the bar is set high.
It's only because you've seen Tarantino movies before, but what he does
worked about it was that it was actually kind of more traditional than his past movies. It wasn't all that
It was much more of a conventional story, but it was great. I mean, he's on my list. I just feel like he was fourth in line.
I feel like if you can back-to-back take, and Chapin and I talked about this a little bit, if you can back-to-back take two of what are arguably the biggest events in human history, controversies or whatever, and simultaneously make them funny and like poignant and emotional and exciting, and with all of that violence and I know the fact that he writes all of these things probably really helps him to be able to do it, but it's incredible, and I'm surprised that Lee, that you don't agree.
No, I do agree. It's hard to have this conversation because I don't disagree with anything that you guys are saying. Like,
right.
I mean, you know, he's a great director. Django was extremely well directed. It wasn't my top two.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that we sometimes get a little bit spoiled and we got to take appreciation for what for Tarantino's like understanding of the medium and just like sort of break it down to that level. And you look at, there's so many scenes in Django that does this, but I've seen Inglourious Basterds more times, so I'll use it as an example, but you take that very first scene in Inglourious Basterds, just that conversation scene and how it's structured and how it's shot and how it's broken down and how the tension builds. And it's something that you can only do in film. And Tarantino just has such a mastery of that I think we forget how good he is at doing that. We just sort of call it Tarantino. We call it like that's a Tarantino Tarantino-ism or something, and we just forget that, you know, he has this ability to manipulate us in such cool ways that, I don't know, that we don't appreciate it.
You actually, when we were talking about it when you were visiting, Jeremy, we talked about how we both kind of agreed that Django could have used another edit.
Which
I still feel is the case, and that's part of what loses points for him, if anything is. Like, it wasn't, you know, start to finish, it wasn't as clean as his movies are. Like, usually his movies are so seamless. For movies that are so discombobulated, usually they're so seamless. And it's actually, it was an issue that I had with Inglourious Basterds, that it felt stagnant to me. Like, it just felt like scene by scene by scene instead of, you know, something cohesive. And for this kind of the same reason, I discredit him for Django in a way that it wasn't as clean. It wasn't as start to finish so perfectly constructed.
I definitely agree it needed one more edit, and I think losing Sally Menke was a big part of that.
I don't think any of his movies are particularly well. I mean, they're not slim by any means. They're all kind of bloated.
Think about a movie like Pulp Fiction or Jackie Brown. There's that movie misses no beats. Like, and Kill Bill is the same way. Like, it's not fair
because Kill Bill is two different movies.
I would call it.
I think you're misunderstanding what I mean by, like, missing a beat or, like, being clean and seamless. Like, think about it as just, like, think about the movie as a whole. Like, it just, everything plays together so well. Like, that it's everything is exactly where it's supposed to be. And when I say it misses no beats, I don't mean that there's a one-year break like there was with Kill Bill. I just mean that, like, it's just...
Well, no, I'm sorry. Maybe you're talking about two different things. You were talking that the movie needed another edit, meaning that I thought you were saying that it was kind of too long
not necessarily too long or anything. I didn't have a problem with the length. I just felt like it wasn't as cleaned up as it could have been.
I mean, felt this was his most linear movie because it was, and in that sense, I was kind of refreshing in a way because I think it's tedious in Inglourious Basterds a little bit to go back and forth. You know, you've seen one thing, and I like Inglourious Basterds better, I think, but I found that the flow of this movie to be refreshing, if anything.
I mean, and when I say, I definitely don't mean that it needed to be shorter. Like, Tarantino said when he made Inglourious Basterds that when he did his final edit, he actually added like 10 minutes, and then he was like, and that actually made it shorter, all right? And, you know, doesn't make any sense, but right. I kind of get what he's saying. Like, you fill in those blanks, and it makes your movie run better, and it's why movies drag, because they're missing something. It's not necessarily because they're full of something else.
Lee and Jeremy, have either of you guys seen Django for a second time?
No.
I think you'll find, as I did, I saw it again, and I felt it was... I felt it was too long. I some parts were a little bit tedious to watch again.
Sure. I mean, I don't disagree. But I think all I'm saying is if we're talking about directors and the mastery of the medium, I don't think... I mean, obviously Tarantino and Spielberg get a ton of credit, but I just think we sometimes forget why.
Yeah. I think, he was number one on my list, so I totally agree with you. I think the biggest compliment to him, because you can only compliment Tarantino by using himself as an example, but I felt for the first time that Django, he was almost being held back, inhibited as a director by his screenplay, which is usually the other way around. Like, he's usually like such a great writer, but I felt that like he almost couldn't. He was almost being held back by his sort of Tarantino-isms in his writing, which I thought was interesting because I thought he was on such... He's just so mastered that directing in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Best pictures of the year.
Who wants to start it off?
Who wants to start it off?
I don't know. I forget whose turn it is.
I'll go. Fuck it.
Argo?
Fuck it. Argo, fuck yourself.
Argo, fuck yourself. Chape and see that movie. Okay, my number 5 was Moonrise Kingdom. My number 4 was Zero Dark Thirty.
So you only did 5?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not with this new school horse shit. It's in a beauty contest, goddammit.
What does that mean?
Moonrise Kingdom.
Zero Dark Thirty. My number three was Looper. My number two was The Master. And my number one was Django Unchained.
All right.
The D is silent.
Jeremy?
And my number 272 was Silver Linings Playbook. Sorry, I thought I should put that in there.
You saw a lot of movies this year.
Yeah, I did. Yes.
Okay, my number my number eight is Silver Linings Playbook. Funny enough. My number seven is Moonrise Kingdom. Number six, Beasts of the Southern Wild. My number five is Argo. My number four is Looper. My number three is Zero Dark Thirty. My number two is Django. And my number one is Lincoln.
All right. My number eight is The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, not to be confused with the other two that will be coming out. My number seven, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, a movie you guys should check out. Nice little movie. That was quite good. Number six, Argo. Number five, Lincoln. Number four, Zero Dark Thirty. Number three, Django Unchained. Number two, Looper. And number one, the controversial Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh, wow. We'll definitely have this discussion then.
Yeah.
Wow, we are going to have a discussion about that movie soon.
Chapin.
Okay, my number eight is Robert Zemeckis' first live-action movie in a long, long time, Flight.
Forrest Gump.
My number seven is Peter Jackson's One of Three, The Hobbit. My number six is the controversial Silver Linings Playbook. My number five is Sam Mendes' Skyfall. My number four is the disappointing Dark Knight Rises. My number
keep putting that so high for not liking a movie.
My number three is Zero Dark Thirty. My number two is the much disputed The Master, and my number one is Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained.
West right. Coast boys got to stick together.
Should we have this discussion on Silver Linings Playbook?
Yes.
All right. So it sounds like, with the exception of Tyson, we all liked it. Like Jeremy, Chapin, you both liked it. I loved it. I mean, I thought. I think the best way to describe this movie for me is
convenient. If
you take the screenplay. So what? I mean, but you take the screenplay, and it's basically like a screenplay that you write in, and granted it's based on a book, but it's like a screenplay you write in high school where, like, you incorporate, like, such major plot points and then also, like, all the things that you like. So it's like, that's why, you know, like, everybody's an Eagles fan. Like, you have to make sure they go to an Eagles game because you're a big Eagles fan. And then, you know, you got, like, mental illness, which is such an obvious plot point, but then, like, you need a widowed person. So, like, what could that be? A cop's wife. The cop was killed. Like, everything is very on the nose. But David O. Russell makes everything work, and like, it's funny. It's poignant. The performances were amazing, and I just think that everything worked. And anytime I like had a doubt about like a scene or where this movie was going, it won me back. And right. I don't know how you can necessarily disagree with that. You could say that.
You can disagree with it. Trust me.
All right, I'll go next, and then Tyson, done? you can finish it off because I feel like you disliked it more than I did. I haven't seen a movie that I simultaneously just couldn't stand bits of and totally fell for at the same time, like this in a long time. In this movie, there was just so many moments where I'm like, how did that just perfectly work out? Like, why did that cop just happen to show up right there? Why are they always running on the road? Do none of them have any cars? It just felt like this, a lot of times with the script, it was just, what's the most convenient way to get across the dialogue and the plot point we need to get across at this time? And then there was like these clunky scenes, like in the living room when they were talking about the parlay with the dance. And
right, that's the one scene I didn't like, and it was almost where the movie lost me, but it ended up winning me. Like I ended up being okay with how
it felt. Like there was a bunch of scenes like that, but then, like,
I'm sorry, what scene are you talking about?
when Jennifer Lawrence comes in and like all of a sudden she knows everything about the Eagles and
and then they start talking about parlaying the dance with the Eagles, and then that's a huge, like, they need that to happen, and you know that they're going to go to the dance and they're going to get what they need and blah blah blah. But like, and all these little pieces like that in this movie just didn't work for me. But if I were to like take an overall look at it, and it's kind of like a puzzle. Like, there's all these pieces that you're putting in and they don't seem right, and then, you know, you'd step back from it and it kind of works. Like, I bought into it by the end, and I almost didn't want to buy into it at the end. And I think a lot of that had to do with Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence. I think the majority of that had to do with
that. And I think De Niro, and I think like Chris Tucker's small performance, like all of that was just, I mean, it was a very refreshing movie for like for things that were very kind of down, like, you know, these characters are not happy people and stuff. And I just think that, and you're right, like, I do think that with lesser performances, this movie would have failed massively, but it didn't have lesser performances. It had great performances.
David O. Russell got very lucky.
Or David O. Russell got that out of him. I mean, look at who we're talking about. We're talking about Bradley Cooper, who we can't stand. I mean, let's give credit where credit is due, and let's also remember that performances are part of what makes a movie whole. So just to say that this movie is only good because the performances are great, is, you can make the same argument about Lincoln.
Look,
I disagree about Lincoln, but I think with this movie, it weirdly, like, being a person who really cares about structure in a screenplay, like, this movie, like, it structurally worked, but at the same time, it was very predictable, and I knew where it was going the whole time. But
I don't understand. I don't know. There's like 20 points I want to disagree with, but Jeremy just saying that about it worked structurally. I thought this movie, when Lee said that about you take this story that you would write in high school, I thought somebody did that, and then they cut it up, and then they forgot how they were supposed to put it back together. Mm. So it just sort of came together in the most like half-assedly, weirdly random way. You had so many of these components that were completely unnecessary, that weren't ever fully established. Chris Tucker, who I love, his character made no sense. I was trying to think about all these things that I wanted to remember specifics. The part where they had him keep leaving the place, and it was like this weird little inside joke that was underdeveloped, and they did it just enough times so that it happened. It was a sort of a like a running gag, but not enough times that I felt like it warranted ever being there. That cop who kept showing up for no good reason, he was always just right there.
Well, that was weak too.
It was poor. I thought it was poorly edited. Like with the decision that they made to have those really weird quick camera zooms, I thought, like, at its core, this was just like a really tacky romantic comedy. And while I will say, I thought both of the actors, the main actors, the core, they had great chemistry. I really bought it. I was really happy that they kissed at the end. And their performances were great. I will give you that. I thought Jennifer Lawrence is much more so than Bradley Cooper's, but it didn't make any sense. I think maybe the worst scene in the whole movie was the scene where they had that conversation about the parlay, and Jennifer Lawrence just comes in and she sort of knows everybody. And when you think it's going to be this really serious emotional scene where they sort of finally address the way Robert De Niro feels about his son's sort of mental illness, they go in this completely different direction when she comes in and they start joking around about him losing all of this money to establish this business, another plot point that was never addressed.
Here's my rebuttals on a couple of points. I think we all can agree that I definitely think the weakest scene in the movie was the scene with the parlay. It was the scene. It was where it almost lost me, but I got past it. But in response to like your, I mean, it was a running gag with Chris Tucker. And my question to you is like, why is that not okay? Like, why, you know, it was funny that he kept showing up, that he kept breaking out of this place. To bog him down with some backstory about why he was there, or to like really fully establish his character, would have been unnecessary. I mean, it was a running joke. It's no different than a one-liner necessarily that would go on throughout a movie.
If it was like, just one character, I would agree with you. But you could say the same exact thing about his brother. You could say the same exact thing about Jennifer Lawrence's sister, Julia Stiles, who was – I mean, why was she even in that movie?
Well, why is Julia Stiles in any movies? But
yeah,
but at the same time, like, you're talking about two different things. Like, the like his brother and Julia Stiles, that's all there kind of as like those are all like characters as a whole, so to speak. Those are, for lack of a better, you know, example, the sisters in the fighter. They're there to establish a setting and a environment. Whereas Chris Tucker is a joke, like, you know, and I think that, you know, in the performances with like Julia Stiles and whoever played David O. Russell's brother, those were weak and they were poorly written to some extent, just because they were like the dialogue and like the points that they were making were always very on the nose. But I think that was all there to create that environment within which these characters are living. But then something like Chris Tucker is an ongoing joke. It's a running joke. And then, you know, the De Niro, who, I mean, I think was it was refreshing to see him good again. Like, you almost forgot who he was. But, you know, he served so many purposes in this movie. Like, he had his own, you know, running jokes and stuff. And while it was a little ludicrous, like the money he spent and his phobias and his superstitions and stuff, it created it proved that, you know, he's kind of crazy too, that like Bradley Cooper gets this from someplace. And I think all those things tied together so well. But you're right. There are aspects of this movie that feel underdeveloped, but I think the ones that are important are either developed or they're not necessary to be developed, if that makes sense.
I mean, this movie, I just think this movie should never have worked. I mean, it was so disjointed and so convenient that it should have driven everyone out of the theater. But I don't know. I mean, maybe give all the credit to David O. Russell. I don't know, but maybe give all the credit to the actors. But something was keeping this movie together to the point, at least for me, that I liked it.
I think that's away. Where like we kind of need to realize that, like, you know, you're saying somehow this movie worked. Maybe it was the performances. Maybe it was David O. Russell. I'm like, well, those are two huge parts of what make movies work. I mean, yeah.
Of course. But you, I think you even agree that this movie had way too many conveniences and was way too disjointed. I mean, it just.
Sure, it did.
I don't know. It's weird. When you can't figure out why a movie should work, it's hard to articulate why it worked for you.
I think it comes down to like how you come to your conclusion. Because for me, like, this is the only movie during Oscar season that I've really wanted to go back and see again. Not for the reason that I need to figure out stuff about. Not for like the reason I would need to see Zero Dark Thirty again. But because I genuinely enjoyed it, I just want to watch it again. And I think that being the case, like, I'm looking at this movie as a whole and how I felt after I saw it. So nitpicking at little things that maybe were underdeveloped or didn't work aren't as important as how this movie came across as a whole.
Probably not, but I don't even think they're nitpicking stuff.
Neither do I. I understand to some extent what you're saying, Lee, but I just feel like, you know, the climactic scene of this movie where you find out that they, I don't know, I felt like there was the payoff that I got at the end wasn't worth all of what I had to go through. I felt like I agree with you. I would have liked to see more of that with Robert De Niro, where you were saying, you know, you can tell that Bradley Cooper gets his neuroses from somewhere. It was cringeworthy for me when Robert De Niro went up to him and he said, like, you know, trust me, you got to trust me. I know that you need to, you know, this girl loves you and blah, blah, blah. After he had just gone over and whispered whatever he whispered into his ex-wife's ear or wife's ear. And it was just, I don't know. The only reason that I didn't just get up and leave, that I didn't just hate it, was because I wanted to see, you know, the mushy side of me wanted to see a sort of romantic payoff of this couple. But I it was all over the place. I mean, I leaned over to Mallory at multiple points during the movie and I was like, this movie is crazy. They need to make up their mind about what we're supposed to be focusing on here. And
this was the kind of movie that, like, it really kind of made me, like, as it was going, like, there was a point in the movie where I felt like the way that the relationship between Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper was going, that I didn't actually want them to end up together. Like, but, you know, then by the end you do. And I still toy with the idea that maybe this movie should have gone in a direction where they were friends and not, you know, romantically together. And And, you know, I do wonder what that movie would have been. And I think, and I always think movies like that are interesting, where like movies like Lost in Translation, where like they push that limit, but they create it in such a way that you, that it would feel wrong if they got together, not just because of the age difference and the idea of Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson being together, but you know, you know, there's something about that that movies can do where they make you understand the relationship. So there was a part of me where I felt like maybe that's where the movie should go, but it didn't. And I ended up being happy with where it went. I wasn't like, it sounds like you were waiting for this movie to get to a point that you wanted it to go. And that I never had that interaction with the movie. I was much more in the moment with it. Like, I just enjoyed watching these characters and like watching their relationship grow. I didn't really care so much as to how this movie was going to end.
Well, and maybe it was part of your, we should come up with a name, the Carlo theory of disappointment or something, where I had expectations and I wanted this movie to deliver. And maybe that's part of why I so vehemently disliked it. But
I mean, it always plays into it. I mean, the extent to which it plays is varies, but expectations always play into the enjoyment of a movie. I mean, you know, still doesn't explain why Dark Knight Rises is number four on Chapin's list.
But. Yeah, Chape, what did you think about this movie, since you haven't said anything?
Well, I think you guys hit it on the head with the expectations. Like, I didn't really have any expectations going into it, and so I just kind of went along with it.
I didn't either, actually. I had very little expectations going into it.
And I think it was just, I kind of thought of it as a genre piece. It's like a new way of a romantic comedy. And I'm not going to sit here and like vehemently defend the movie. I wasn't like that in love with it at all. But it did work for me, and I think I can explain it just in that, you know, just in that you are watching this with all the conventions of romantic comedies in your head, and it kind of just defies them and kind of twists them on their head. And, you know, I think there's something to the fact that you, like, I mean, I hate this kind of stuff most of the time, like these like touchy-feely type of movies. But, you know, at the end, I kind of wanted to see them like win that dance contest, you know, like I kind of was along for the ride, and they were awful in it, which I thought was great. Like, you know, it ultimately kind of, like, every time you were expecting it, or even you knew you wanted something to happen, it wouldn't. And I thought
it
that
would
was,
happen, but not in the same way that you sort of expected
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
The cliche way for it to happen. And I think that's one of the bigger saving graces of this movie.
Exactly. And honestly, I mean, I know you guys hated that scene. I didn't have a problem with the parlay scene at all.
It won me over by the end. I just didn't like how it kind of unfolded.
Right. And I don't think none of them, I mean, part of that scene was her sort of talking down, you know, just kind of everybody being tired of the OCD of both of those characters. I mean, like, I think Bradley Cooper's OCD was a sort of a different ilk than his father's. Like, his father's was much easier to sort of deconstruct and figure out where it came from. But, you know, she'd been dealing with that the whole time, and you know, they had missed their last rehearsal. And then she comes in and she clearly realizes where that comes from in this ridiculous bedding. So, of course, that, you know, nobody, I don't think the movie or the two lead characters bought into that parlay or the, you know, the idea that, you know, something magical was going to happen in order to save the day. It was just sort of a, you know, they just had to get to that very, very low number on the from the judges in order to get there. And it's sort of stuff like that. Like it was sort of, you know, in if that movie were done in a sort of cliche Hollywood way, it would be them, you know, either winning or losing the contest. But in fact, they were just clearly out of their league, and, you know, they're dancing.
And it was brilliant when they got the five and they were so excited, right, and nobody knew what they were cheering about. And I could have done without the line from the guy that just basically told us everything we were watching when he's like, why are they so excited about getting a five? Like,
right.
Definitely could have done without that. But I thought it was just brilliant, like, you with that enthusiasm that was there and, like, everybody else not knowing what was going on.
Yeah, and
I agree, and that's good. And that's good writing. Like, that's part of this why it's number five on my best screenplay.
So now you're happy with the directing, the acting, and the writing.
But there was just so many, like, points where the writing was so bad and the convenience was so out, you know, crazy.
I get what you're saying.
You know, it's just like, and that's why this movie for me is so hard to articulate, because, you know, there are points that I just hated, and there are points that I look back on it at the end, and I was like, kind of like that. Why did I like that? So, you know, and sometimes there's just movies that do that, and this is one of them.
Thank you again for joining us for this most recent and newly developed version of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. Join us again next week when we discuss, insert movie here. join us again next week when we discuss another movie. We'll probably go back to 2012 and discuss some of the great movies we've mentioned briefly on this podcast. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.